Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a story that, honestly, it gets right under your skin.
Yeah.
At us this really fundamental question.
It does.
What happens when you can't tell your own life story anymore? I mean, really think about that. That agency is just gone.
And it's not just that you forget. It's that other people or, you know, other things start telling it for you. Directing it.
Literally, in this case, literally directing it. Imagine your life isn't your own monologue anymore. It's a script. And you're just a character being watched. Maybe from a camera, maybe even from the sky.
It's a deeply unsettling premise. Yeah. And the source material we're digging into today handles it with this incredible mix of surreal, almost slapstick comedy and just devastating tragedy.
Right. We're talking about The Fantastic Confabulations of an Aging Tennis Player by Nick Owen.
A fantastic title, by the way.
It really is. Now, I just want to say, for anyone listening who heard Aging Tennis Player and thought, okay, here we go, a sports story. Are we going to be talking about Wimbledon stats?
No. No backhands today.
No backhands. I promise.
Right.
You can just put that thought aside right now. This is something else entirely. It's experimental. It's strange. And frankly, it's a bit of a puzzle box.
A very weird puzzle box, yeah. We're talking about sentient drones. We're talking about trapdoors.
We are. But before we get into all of that, and believe me, we have to properly situate this book. It's not a standalone, is it? And reading it as one, you'd miss almost everything.
You'd miss the entire emotional core. It's absolutely crucial to understand that this is the end. This is the final act of a four-part story, a quartet.
Okay, so it's a quartet.
Exactly. The author, Nick Owen, he built this whole world, this whole life, around this one character named Andy. It began years ago with the first book, The Confessions of an Aging Tennis Player.
The Confessions? Okay, so that's book one.
Then came the second, The Courting Lives of an Aging Tennis Player.
Courting Lives, got it.
Followed by the third, which was The Norman Conquests of an Aging Tennis Player. So you see this progression, right? Confessions, courting, conquests. It's a life being lived.
It implies action. Agency. These are things he did.
Precisely. And that's what makes the title of this final book so jarring. It's not about action anymore. It's The Final Confabulations of an Aging Tennis Player.
And that word, confabulations, I want to stick with that for a second because it feels so different from the others.
Yeah.
It's clinical. It doesn't sound like something you do. It sounds like something that happens to you.
It is clinical, 100%. In psychology, a confabulation is a specific type of memory error. It's when your brain produces these fabricated or, you know, distorted memories about your life, about the world.
So it's lying.
See, that's the heartbreaking part. It's not lying. The person isn't trying to deceive you at all. They believe with every fiber of their being that what they're saying is the truth. Their brain is just, it's desperately filling in the gaps.
So it's a coping mechanism.
It's a survival mechanism. It's the mind trying to build a coherent story to protect itself from a reality that's become too fragmented, too painful to process. And that's the engine for this entire book.
Wow.
But the first thing that hits you, especially if you've been on this journey through the other three books, is the format. It's a total shock to the system.
Right. The first three were all prose. They were standard novels. We were inside Andy's head, hearing his thoughts.
It was his internal monologue. He was our narrator. He was telling us his story.
He was in charge.
And in this book, that's all gone. The format is completely different. It's written as a screenplay.
A script with scene headings, character names, dialogue.
Yep. Stage directions, camera angles, everything.
That is such an aggressive choice for an author to make. It feels like it's designed to push the reader away, to distance us.
I think it is supposed to be distancing. The author has actually called it a narrative necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense if you think about it. If your main character is, you know, losing his grip on reality, probably through dementia or just extreme old age, he can't narrate his own story in prose anymore.
Because his thoughts aren't linear.
They're not. So he stops being the subject, the storyteller, and he becomes the object. He's no longer the one speaking. He is the one being watched. The camera lens literally replaces the mind's eye.
That's chilling. It's the ultimate loss of control. You're not the author of your own life. You're just a character in a scene someone else is directing.
Exactly.
So let's meet this character. Who is Andy as he exists in this screenplay?
Well, see, that is the million-dollar question. It completely depends on who you ask. If you ask Andy himself,
He'll
tell you he is Lord Andrew John Paul George Ringo Murray of Kirk and Tillock.
Hang on. John Paul George Ringo, he thinks he's a Beatle. And Andy Murray.
He sort of mashed together every major British cultural icon he can remember into one glorious persona. He's a tennis god, a pop star, a member of the House of Lords. And in his mind, he's just in this place recovering from a minor injury. A sprained knee. He's very clear on this. He picked it up on a grass court last Saturday.
But the screenplay, the camera, it doesn't let us live in that fantasy with him, does it? What's the reality?
The reality, what the camera sees is brutal. Scene two. The stage directions describe him not as a lord, not as a beetle, but as an elderly, frail man. He's got wispy hair, a goatee, and he's lying alone in a single wardroom in a hospice.
And that time discrepancy is the first huge shock. He's thinking it's been a few days.
And the other characters, they start to gently, or sometimes not so gently, feed him the truth. He hasn't been there for a week. He's been in this hospice for 12 years.
That's an entire chapter of a life just gone.
Yeah.
It's like a sci-fi story, but it's just the grim reality of memory loss.
And the author uses the screenplay format to really hammer home this sense of entrapment. The whole book opens with a drone shot.
I found this opening so effective. It doesn't feel like a story about an old man. It feels like the start of some dystopian thriller, right? Blade Runner or something.
It totally does. The camera starts low, right on a tennis ball on a court. Then it just pulls up and up and up. It flies over Liverpool. It starts tracking a prison van. Then it hovers over an actual prison. And then it finally settles on the hospital, the hospice. It's this god's eye view, but it's cold. It's mechanical. It tells you from frame one. This is a world of surveillance. You are being watched.
The setting is officially the South Liverpool Hospice for Retired Gentlemen. But based on that opening and how Andy experiences it, it's a prison.
It's the Panopticon.
Okay, let's unpack that term. I know it gets thrown around a lot, but what does it mean in this context?
Well, the Panopticon was this this concept for a prison designed so that a single guard in a central tower could see every single inmate, but the inmates couldn't see the guard. They never knew if they were being watched at any given moment.
So they had to behave as if they were always being watched.
Exactly. It forces self-regulation. And in this hospice, that central guard tower is the drone fleet. It's a place of constant monitoring. It's about management, not comfort.
And Andy feels that, doesn't he? He's paranoid. Even about the robotic vacuum cleaner.
He's terrified of it. He calls it a bloody great rat.
Which is funny, but it's also incredibly sad. Because to him, this little automated machine just doing its job is some kind of malevolent vermin.
It's a symbol of how impersonal and alienating his world has become. The machine doesn't care about him. He's just an obstacle to be cleaned round. It doesn't care about his imaginary knighthood or his tennis trophies. It just needs to get to the dust under his bed.
So we have this protagonist who has gone from being our narrator to being a monitored subject. But he's not totally alone in this prison hospice. There's a supporting cast, and this is where the story's weird tone really comes into focus. There are these two women who are almost always at his bedside, and it's really important to get their roles straight.
Yes, their functions are very, very different. First, you have Joan.
Joan. She's the care worker, the official staff member.
Right. Joan is the good cop, in a sense. She's the one who brings him his medication, which is often just to sedate him when he gets agitated. She plays along with his fantasy, calls him Mr. Murray. She's the sympathetic face of the system.
But she's still part of the system.
Absolutely. She's compassionate, but she's just following orders. She can't save him. She can only, you know, manage his decline and make him comfortable while he waits.
Okay, so that's Joan. Then there's Grace.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Grace's reason for being there, it's just wonderfully darkly absurd.
It's pure Kafka. It's ridiculous. Grace is the secretary of the tennis club.
Not a nurse. Not a doctor. Not a relative.
No. She is not there to offer comfort or hold his hand. She is there on official business. She is there to collect a debt.
A debt. From a man who thinks he's one of the Beatles and has been in a hospice for 12 years, she's chasing him for overdue fees.
It's so much more petty than that. It's not just fees. She comes in with a ledger. She has itemized it. She tells him he owes, and the specificity is what makes it so brutal. £2,566.78.
That 0.78p is the killer. It's so bureaucratic.
It's the intrusion of the mundane real world into this end-of-life space. And he's floating in this mythic reality of being a sports hero, and Grace is there to drag him crashing back to earth over unpaid bar bills and compound interest.
And his reaction is just brilliant. He doesn't just take it. He fights back with the only weapons he has left, confusion and sarcasm.
He calls her Tinkerbell.
Why Tinkerbell? What's the connection?
Because early on, she's trying to get his attention, and she mentions needing to ring the bell for assistance. So in his muddled mind, she's associated with bells. He just looks at her and tells her to, and this is a direct quote, "Ting a bloody ling."
Ting a bloody ling. I love that. It shows that even in this frail state, that defiant spark, that bit of wit, it's still there.
It's his shield. It's his defense against being tittied. Because Grace looks at him and she says this awful thing. She says, "When I think of how he used to look, and I look at him now, it's so condescending."
It's devastating.
And Andy just fires back, "You talking about me? What state's that then?" He refuses to be defined as a state. He will not accept that label.
And these two characters, Joan and Grace, they also serve another key narrative function. They're his only connection to the outside world, and they try to anchor him in time by mentioning these huge world-changing events.
Yeah, this is a really clever bit of writing. The author uses COVID and Brexit as these temporal landmarks.
The kind of thing everyone lived through.
Right. Grace asks him, "You know COVID, the lockdowns, the clapping, things that are seared into our collective memory."
And Andy's response is just a total blank.
No idea what you're talking about.
It's wild. For us, for you listening, those events defined years of our lives. They changed everything. For Andy, inside that room, inside his head, they literally did not happen.
He was mentally absent. He just dismisses it all as nonsense. He thinks they're making it up to mess with him. When they mention political figures like Nigel Farage or Jeremy Corbyn, he has no idea who they are. His mind is effectively frozen in amber from a time before all of that.
It raises a really fascinating and kind of uncomfortable philosophical question, doesn't it?
Is he better off?
Yeah. Is blissful ignorance, this confabulation, actually preferable to the harsh reality we all had to live through? Is it better to be Sir Andy Murray recovering from a sprain than an old man who spent a global pandemic locked in a hospice?
The book never gives you an easy answer to that. It just lets the question hang there.
Speaking of the hospice, we need to get back to the surveillance. Because the drones aren't just a clever camera angle in the opening, they become characters in their own right.
This is where the screenplay format lets the author get really surreal and playful. The drones are anthropomorphized. They're not just machines. They have names: Johnny, Colin, Jerry.
And personalities. Johnny is the main one we follow.
And what's so brilliant is that Johnny the drone is a mirror for Andy the man. Johnny is also aging.
An aging drone? How does that work?
Well, his sensors are starting to fail. He's struggling to do his job, which is to disperse his cargo.
And what is his cargo? What are they dropping on the patients?
This is another piece of dark satire. It's a mix of medication, sedatives, but also betting slips and confetti.
Betting
Yeah.
slips.
It's this cynical commentary on how we treat the elderly, keep them drugged, keep them distracted with trivial things like gambling and bright colors. It's the bread and circuses model for the terminally ill.
Just keep them quiet and docile.
Exactly. But Johnny is failing at it. He's old and he's developed feelings.
Right, he's in love.
He is. Johnny the drone is desperately in love with the automatic door at the hospice entrance. He
Oh.
calls her Martina.
As in Martina Navratilova.
One has to assume it's a tennis-themed hospice, I guess. There's this bizarrely sweet scene where he's hovering in front of the door, just pleading with it, "Pretty please, I'll make it up to you later."
It's like a scene out of Wall-E or something. A little bit of warmth and connection in this horribly sterile, cold environment.
And that warmth is echoed in one of the human characters, Evelyn Williams. She's the mechanic. She works in the workshop fixing the drones.
I loved Evelyn. She feels like the only truly good person in the whole place. She's the heart of the story in a way.
She is the resistance. She's this small beacon of humanity in this place of cold, robotic efficiency. What does she do? She sings old show tunes to the machines while she works on them.
Oklahoma and My Fair Lady.
Exactly. People will say we're in love. She's singing it to the drones. She treats them with care and affection.
And that puts her on a direct collision course with the story's main antagonist.
It does, because the administrator of the hospice orders Evelyn to scrap Johnny. She says he's old and broken and useless.
Which is, of course, exactly how the system and the administrator sees Andy.
It's a perfect parallel. The drone is a stand-in for the man. They're both seen as obsolete machinery.
But Evelyn refuses. She defies the order.
In secret. She pretends to scrap him, but instead she repairs him. She saves him. And not just that, she turns him into a secret agent. She uses him to smuggle messages to Andy.
On post-it notes.
Little yellow post-it notes. She loads them into Johnny's cargo bay. It's this tiny, beautiful, desperate act of rebellion against the system. She's trying to reach Andy, maybe to warn him, or just to let him know someone out there still cares.
So we have the rebellion brewing in a workshop, which means we have to talk about the Empire. We have to talk about Mrs. Carter.
Mrs. Carter, she is set up from the very beginning as the ultimate villain, the Nurse Ratched figure.
She's the administrator. She's obsessed with spreadsheets, with time and money. Everything is a resource to be managed.
And the way she talks about Andy is so creepy. She calls him my Mr. Murray. That little pause, that possessive my.
Like, he's her property. She controls everything. She isolates him. She blocks visitors like Grace and this young tennis coach, Cameron, from seeing him. She wants him completely under her thumb. She is the jailer.
She seems to be, yes. But then we get to scene 18. And this is the moment. This is the pivot on which the entire four-book series turns. It changes everything.
It completely recontextualizes the whole story.
The entire quartet. Hmm. Mrs. Carter is in Andy's room. He's asleep or sedated. And she's there for what she calls a capability review, which is just this cold corporate jargon for deciding if he's worth the expense anymore.
And she's frustrated. She's talking to herself, yeah, into the sleeping Andy. And the mask just... it just drops.
She gives this monologue, and I think we have to look at the words here very closely. She says, what if you were me, Andy?
Yeah.
If you were stood here looking down at your daughter.
Okay, now, let's pause on that. Daughter. Hmm. Andy is a man. What's going on there? Is it a mistake in the text?
I don't think so. Yeah. In a book this surreal about dementia and confused identity, it's almost certainly deliberate. It could be reflecting Andy's own confused state, or maybe she's speaking metaphorically about the vulnerability of the child she's looking at. But the next line. The next line clarifies everything.
What does she say?
She says, they say a mother's love has no end, but do you know what, Andy? This mother ran out of that resource many years ago.
This mother. Mrs. Carter is his mother.
And that revelation just hit me like a physical blow. Because in an instant, she transforms. She's not a monster. She's not Nurse Ratched. She's a parent. A parent who has been pushed past her breaking point and has absolutely nothing left to give.
It changes the entire genre of the story. It's not One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest anymore. It's a tragic, private, domestic drama about caregiver burnout.
And listen to the details she reveals in that speech. She talks about going to prison. She mentions ending up in that hospital. She says she risked everything to get him to Paris.
So the real Andy, before the hospice, he wasn't a tennis champion.
Not even close. The implication is that he was deeply troubled. Maybe he had a criminal record, maybe severe mental health problems long before any dementia set in. Yeah. He was a constant source of trouble and pain for her. He was found in Calais trying to get into the country. He was stateless, a refugee.
And so, The Confessions of an Aging Tennis Player, the first book, the whole foundation of his identity. That was the confabulation.
That was the grand fiction. He built this glorious, celebrated life as a sports hero to completely erase a past of failure, of prison, of disappointment. And she, his mother, Mrs. Carter, she went along with it.
She protected him. This hospice, this prison, wasn't meant to be a prison. It was a sanctuary she built to keep him safe from the world and maybe to keep the world safe from him.
But after decades of this, she's done. That line, this well has run dry. It's one of the most brutal and honest things I've ever read about the limits of love. We have this ideal of a mother's love is infinite, but this story just says no. Even that has a bottom.
And having finally admitted that to herself, she makes a decision.
This revelation is the trigger for the book's climax. She decides it's time for Andy to fly the nest, but she doesn't just kick him out.
No. This is where the surrealism comes roaring back. It's not a quiet discharge. It's a literal ejection.
It is. The floor beneath his bed just opens up a trapdoor.
It's horrifying. Like something a James Bond villain would do.
Exactly. A platform slowly lowers his bed down into the bowels of the hospice. It's the ultimate act of being discarded. He is literally being thrown away with the trash.
But Andy's mind, it doesn't register the horror. It translates it into something else.
It does. As he descends into this dark, mechanical underbelly, he's not alone. He's accompanied by the hospice cat.
The cat named Spooty. S-P-O-T-Y.
Sports personality of the year, of course.
Of course. Another piece of his fantasy made real.
And the cat guides him out of the darkness, out of the basement, and into this blindingly bright forest.
It's his version of heaven. It's tennis heaven.
It has to be. He finds a perfect tennis club on top of a mountain. And the screenplay describes young, oiled, athletic tennis players. They're all there. And they greet him not as a patient, but as a hero. They call him Sir Andrew Murray.
And he's not frail anymore. He physically transforms.
Yeah, the stage directions say he looks down at his own thin, frail arms and legs and watches as they bulk up with muscle. He becomes young and powerful again. This is it. This is the fantastic confabulation in its final, most powerful form.
He's rejected the reality of his mother's abandonment and created this perfect afterlife for himself.
He's finally become the man he always told himself he was. But the story isn't over. There's one more shift.
A final twist.
We cut from Tennis Heaven, and he wakes up. But he's not in the basement. He's not in the hospice at all. He's outside, on the street.
And he's with people.
He is. He's with Grace, the debt collector, and Cameron, the young coach. And then the impossible happens. Evelyn, the mechanic, is there too.
Wait, Mrs. Carter told us Evelyn was dead. She said she'd been scrapped, just like the drone.
Andy points that out. He looks at her confused and says, "They told me you were dead." And Evelyn's response is amazing. She just smiles and says, "Unbelievable, but true."
And what about the debt? The $2,500?
Cameron, the coach, tells him not to worry about it. He says all the members at the tennis club had a whip round. They all chipped in.
They paid it off for him.
Every penny. He owes nothing. He's free.
Yeah, they give him presents.
Yeah.
The baseball cap and a gold tankard. And the final scene is the group of them just walking off together, heading to the club to watch the U.S. Open final on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's a perfect happy ending.
It is a perfect happy ending. It's too perfect.
Ah, so you don't think it's real?
I mean, let's just look at the evidence. A man is dropped through a trapdoor into a dungeon by his mother who has rejected him. The next thing we know, he's outside, his debts have been magically erased by the very people who were hounding him for them, and a character we were told was dead is alive and well.
So this happy ending?
Yeah.
This is the final confabulation.
That's the most powerful reading of the text, I think. This isn't a miraculous rescue. This is the moment of death. This is the brain's last beautiful, defiant act. It's firing off this final, perfect narrative to comfort him as he slips away.
Oh, man. That is somehow so much more beautiful and also so much sadder.
It's an act of self-mercy. The truth that he was unloved and discarded is just too brutal for anyone to bear. So his mind writes him a better ending. Debts forgiven, friends reconciled. Heading off to watch one last great tennis match.
And the very last shot of the book seems to support that reading. We don't stay with Andy. We go back to the drone.
We go back to Johnny.
Johnny and another drone, just flying high over the River Mersey. And they're chatting to each other.
In a thick Scouse accent. Just all right, law. Sound law.
The human drama is over, but the machines, the surveillance system, they just keep on flying.
It's so ambiguous. Does Andy escape to a real happy ending? Or does the system just watch impassively as another one of its subjects fades away? The book just leaves you there with that question.
And it's a brilliant, haunting way to end it.
Okay, let's go back for a moment. I really want to dig into that scene between Grace and Andy a bit more because it's so rich with that dark comedy and it sets up all these themes so perfectly.
Scene 3. Yeah. So Andy wakes up. He's completely out of it. And Grace just says, "Hello, Andy." His response is just, "Who?" He has no idea.
And that's when she says that terrible pitying line, "When I think of how he used to look, and I look at him now."
It's just so cruel. Mm. And you see that flicker of his old self, that pride, when he snaps back. What states that then?
"He will not be an object of pity." And then he just lashes out. "And what's your name?" Tinkerbell.
Laughing. And she says, "No, Annie, it's Grace." And he just tells her, "Grace, do me a favor, F off and leave me alone, will you?"
It just cuts right through her condescension. He doesn't want her sympathy. He just wants to be left alone.
And then he tries to rationalize who she is. He denies being a tennis player, which is so ironic because that's the core of his grand delusion.
Right. When he's alone, he's Andy Murray, Wimbledon champion.
Okay.
But when the actual secretary from his small local club shows up, he rejects it. Because admitting he was part of a local club would mean admitting he wasn't the world number one.
So his brain just edits it out. He says the tennis players are down the corridor. This section is for film stars.
It's the delusion protecting itself, elevating his status to avoid the uncomfortable truth. It's a masterful depiction of how that works.
And then she hits him with the debt, the £2,566.78.
And he tries to argue. He says, "I might have the constitution of an ox, but I couldn't get through 1,500 quid's worth of booze on a Saturday afternoon."
He genuinely believes this is a bar tab from a single day. The idea that 12 years have passed is just. It's an impossible concept for his mind to grasp.
And you feel for Grace, just a little, when she has to be the one to tell him. We're not talking about just one Saturday afternoon. We're talking years.
The banality of it. Chasing a Man Lost in Time for Compound Interest.
It's comedy and tragedy smashed together in every single line of dialogue.
And I think that's the key to the whole book. It never lets you get comfortable. Just when you think it's a tragedy, it makes you laugh.
Yeah.
And just when you're laughing at the absurdity of a talking drone, it hits you with the devastating reality of a mother giving up on her child.
It keeps you completely off balance, which I think is meant to mirror Andy's own state of mind. We, the readers, become as disoriented as he is.
So, at the end of the day, what's the big takeaway? Why should you, listening at home, care about this strange little story?
I think it's because it's a profound meditation on identity. We all tell ourselves stories about who we are. It's how we build our sense of self. I'm a good employee. I'm a loving parent. I'm a loyal friend.
And this story shows just how fragile those narratives are.
Frighteningly fragile. A diagnosis, an accident, even just the simple process of aging, and that story you've spent a lifetime building can be erased and replaced by a medical chart. Replaced by what other people say you are.
It's about the fight for control of that narrative. And Andy, in his own way, he fights to the very end.
He does. He may lose the battle with reality, but in the final moments, his mind wins the war. He creates a narrative that gives him peace. And the book seems to argue that maybe, just maybe, that final comforting lie is more important, more humane than the cold, brutal truth.
The confabulation isn't the sickness. It's the cure.
It's the survival strategy. It's how he endures the unendurable.
So here's the final thought I want to leave you with. If your life story is eventually taken out of your hands, and for many of us, it will be, through illness or age, if it's told by others, by charts, by drones, by worried relatives, does the truth of who you were even matter anymore? Or is the only thing that matters the comfort of the final story you're able to tell yourself?
A provocative question, and one this book forces you to confront.
A fantastic, unsettling, and brilliant piece of work. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive into the final confabulations of an aging tennis player.
It's quite a journey.
It really is. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you on the next deep dive.